Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, and today we have a very special guest. You're going to love him. His name is Ray Crist. He is a former fashion and advertising photographer and is now the founder of the Jaguar Path School for Modern Shamanism and the Science of Healing. Doesn't that sound cool? So welcome to the studio, Ray Crist. Am I saying it right, Crist? Right.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
Okay. Hi, all right, Hillary. Well, welcome. Hi. This is going to be so interesting. Yeah. Okay. So I've already learned that Ray, he was born in Greece, right? No, you were born in the States, born in the United States, moved to Greece at age 7. And so do you want to, so my first question is, what had your parents move to Greece?
Well, my mother was Greek and my father was American, and they met in college in the university when in the States, and then when they had the family, they decided that they wanted to live in Greece, so they moved us, the whole family. My sister was 10, I was 7, we all moved here. In 1971, we moved in Greece.
Wow. And was that a culture shock?
As a seven-year-old, there was no cultural shock. Everything was just magic, and everything was in, you know, my play world. It was wonderful. I was in Livingston, New Jersey. It's a beautiful suburb in Livingston. Really sweet. I remember this, you know, just the grass and the beautiful little houses and my big wheels. And then we moved to Greece, and we were really close to, by the sea. So then it was like my bicycle again, and going swimming and being at the sea. Everything was wonderful.
And were you on the mainland or the islands?
I was in the mainland in Athens, and I did grow up there. And then I proceeded to study as a photographer and cinematography. And eventually, again, I jumped into a career of becoming a photographer. And I thoroughly enjoyed that for a good 20 years. Till the age of 39, till everything was stopped. So I got into fashion photography and advertising photography, and I had a very successful career.
And did you do that like all over the world?
I did it mainly in Greece, in Athens, Greece, and based essentially in Europe. My claim to fame was covers of Vogue, and basically all the great advertisement agencies with bulletin advertisements, big bulletin boards in the city and the airports and the works. I had a very successful career. I was really happy with that. And even looking back, I'm happy. Yet it was cut short, or maybe it wasn't short. It was complete at the time, because all that success meant that I would work 80 hours a week, 6-7 days a week. It was a constant go, go, go. Big budgets, short deadlines, and no end to that, to work itself. So that had become really stressful, and essentially more stressful than I knew.
Mm. And how did you, just one more question, how did you get like discovered or make it so big? I mean, obviously you were good, or they wouldn't have used you for covers of Vogue and stuff like that. But how did that happen for someone who might be wanting that career? How did you make that happen?
Well, I don't know how things work now, but back in the day, I did it the old classic way, where I was a assistant photographer at a big studio, and I worked there for 4 or 5 years. And through working there, I quickly made myself a photographer within the studio. I picked up all the small clients, helped. I climbed up the hierarchy in there. I made myself from assistant to photographer while receiving the same money without asking for any raise. So I was more useful. I was making more money for them. And through that, I basically really was introduced to a lot of people in the magazine world. A lot of people knew me through the years. And when I opened, the people that I worked for were absolutely wonderful people, and they really supported me through learning as a young photographer and as their assistant, to all the way to when I opened the studio, they actually gave me my first five or six clients. They would even lend me their cameras and some lights as I build my own. It was so, I guess I got there through support of others and loving acceptance. And I was good. I was good. I really, really loved photography. Really loved it. So I gave it my all. That's all I did. You know, while, you know, I was still 20 when I got in there as an assistant. And I would work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. That was my minimum time. Like, so I was super dedicated. While all my other friends, 20 and 22 and 25, were all around on the motorcycles and going out and playing or going to the bars or whatever there was, I was just focused on photography and focused on my career.
Wow. Now, do you think, because you were giving without asking back, like for more money, that came back in return where they gave you those five clients? You know, like the law of nature, you know, the laws?
Absolutely. I was giving and I still am. I think that's a big hack in life. Big hack to like want to engage when you decide, because for me, it was my dream job to be an assistant photographer, right? Mm-hmm. I was a kid. I got in there like when I was 19, so 19, 20 maybe. And so I gave it my all because I think that's the only way to learn anything and succeed in anything, to really, really dedicate yourself to what you're doing and believe in it and love it and enjoy it. So I worked there like that, even as the assistant in the beginning. I would always like clean all the lenses and mop the studio and paint the backdrops and do above and beyond what was asked of me because I loved it. So, and you know what, and I still believe it, and now even more so in this new shamanic world that I live in, and that is my new reality. When you're dedicated to something, automatically life gives you back gifts. That's the hack. So whatever you do to love it and loving it, I would say actively when it's happening and fully present.
Now, you know, yeah. Would you say, because I remember way back, when I had a job that I did not like, I found what I did love, and I love to acknowledge people, you know? So I decided to do that at my job because I love doing it. And even though I didn't necessarily love the job itself, I brought the pieces of life that I love to the job.
That's beautiful.
Which helped. Beautiful. Yeah. So there might be people listening who say, I don't want to dedicate my life to this job, but they could dedicate it maybe to parts of it that they do love or what, you know, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. If you could ask someone else and they could say, well, you know, I had to mop the studios and I had to paint, then I had to wait for years to go up the steps of evolution in that industry. And it was a very closed industry. It was hard, but that was not my experience. While that was happening, my experience was I was happy through and through. I was happy when I was mopping the studio. I was happy when I was doing the covers for Vogue magazine. It's like I was into both. All those parts of life mix. So I think it's attitude that I bring, that positive attitude. Yeah. And
you weren't trying to get someplace, right? You were just happy in the moment. Yeah.
No, it all happened. Yeah. It all just in a way happened. It took years, of course, but it just happened.
You know, it's so interesting. you know, I've had this show for a couple of years, and so I had this goal, and I was gonna, you know, I was gonna create the second income so I could retire from my sales job, and you know, it just wasn't working, and I was getting madder and madder and more frustrated and more frustrated, and finally I was like, you know what, I've learned a lot, I love doing it, I'm letting it go. And when I let it go, like, stuff starts happening. You know, the views on the E360 TV have been going up. My YouTube is going, you know, because I let go of needing to get someplace, I think. And absolutely. I just love it. And it's really a different shift of my entire body and being and energy, you know. And I just said, hey, whatever's supposed to happen now will happen. And I try to do what's best for my guest, you know? It's a different energy, but I love your story that even mopping the floors, you loved it. I think it's a great lesson for people, especially people starting out, you know, if they can just enjoy where they're at, not feel entitled, perhaps. I think there's a sense of entitlement.
Or not rushing for some future. It's just like really being present in every moment.
Yeah. It's great.
And I love is a surrender is a key word, I feel, that you just mentioned. Is a surrender it. Because when you get, I mean, it's one thing. I was absolutely goal-oriented, and I did want to become a photographer, but I was patient through every stage of it. Mm. I was present, I should say, through every stage of it. I wasn't waiting for that stage to end. It was just, and that's why I felt it naturally unfolded.
So interesting. It's like counterintuitive, you know, but right? You think you have to force it.
It's counterintuitive, you know? For the Western mind and what taught and what we've been told. It's like, try, go harder, work more, try, go harder. And eventually, you know, it's just like the beginning part of it was really sweet and easy for me as I got in it. But then when I was in it, I was, you know, riding this fast jet of that world of fashion and advertisement, which was nonstop. And again, I thought I was really, really enjoying it, but it really turned out, you know, completing 20 years that I did burn out. I did burn out by it. And it brought that to a sudden halt by a cancer diagnosis at 39. In 2003, brought all that to a very sudden halt. Well, I had other plans. The universe was like, okay, you've done this part of your life, and this has to come to an end. And if you're ready to start another part, we'll give you a second chapter, or else just this will be it. So I got a stage 4. I got a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer, bilateral renal carcinoma. Both my kidneys had spread to my lungs and liver, and basically in the hospital they told me, you will not survive this, you have about 3 months to live. And it perhaps would not make sense to start doing surgeries, because it will just not cut it. It won't save you necessarily, and you'll just won't save you basically.
It must have been a fun day hearing that. What did you
know,
do?
It was the first day of my life. It was the last day of that life. And along with it came a lot of mourning and grief and fear. And there's that stage of 6 months of being in this state of basically getting things together, closing my studio down, closing everything, and giving way to the first day of my life. So as terrifying as it was, it worked exactly like when we hear about near-death experiences, awakening someone. So it was by all means a near-death experience, in the sense that I recognized there's this doctor, there's this scans that were saying you will die. And in front of death, a lot of interesting things happen. Your whole brain begins to want to reorient. All your priorities start moving up and down and shifting, and you begin to realize that a lot of the things I began to realize that a lot of things that I thought important, first of all, Vogue covers and all that, were not. All the things that I had stress about in some relationships and fear or anger or animosities or a lot of things in my relationships, all of a sudden I found to be so useless. That we're not adding anything to my reality. And if I had those 90 days that they gave me, I realized that I'm not going to spend it in anger or animosity or fear or anger. It really clarified my values and rearranged my priorities. I think the most interesting thing and why we're sitting here today and why I'm still alive 20 years later, is that there was this part of me in the back of my brain when I was young, when I was 16, my beloved sister had given me a book by this guy and this anthropologist by the name of Carlos Castaneda. And this guy, Carlos Castaneda, went down to Mexico to interview for his dissertation, to interview a medicine man by the name of Don Juan Matus. And as he went there to write his PhD dissertation, he ended up doing a lot more. Carlos Castaneda wrote, I'm going to say 18 books till the end of his life. That was mid-80s. He died on his apprenticeship with the shaman shaman Don Juan Matus in Mexico. And I had read three or four or five books of him from 16 to like 20 or something. And then, of course, when photography came and I got my first motorcycle and I was free and I had rented my own apartment and I was a grown up, all those beautiful things took over my life, my focus, my everything. So that kind of went disappeared out of focus. But when this happened, I was in Greece. And as I said, when this happened, when I received my diagnosis, I was living in Greece. And I felt that in my despair, I got up and left Athens and I went north of Athens to the Oracle of Delphi. Now, the Oracle of Delphi is one of the most expansive archaeological sites here and one of the richest in the sense that it was the Oracle and it was kind of like the Switzerland of the time. There was no war. It was a no-war zone. And all the city-states, the Athenians, the Spartans, the Thebans, the Tibetan, the from Thebes, the Corinthians, all of them each built a temple as a gift to the oracle because the oracle was there to answer, to give answers, right? So when a king or a sergeant had to make a big decision, he would go to the oracle and ask, and the oracle would speak to the gods. And the oracle would sit over this thing of smoke. And as the smoke would come, the oracle was three women. And as the smoke smoke would come out of the floor, essentially, of the temple. And it was these gases released, natural gases released from the stone itself. And they would speak in language. And then the high priest would translate the language and give the answer to the kings or the sergeants or the important people, right? So I was inspired, and of course I went there. Back then, things were really still kind of like, there's not a lot of rules and regulations in Greece as we know.
Now, when was it? Was this when back when you were 16, or is this now after diagnosis?
Thank you for asking for the clarification. Yeah. This is 2003.
Okay.
Right at the peak of my career and when I was diagnosed with cancer. Okay. So,
So you went to the Oracle.
To ask the Oracle, to sit in meditation. Of course, I know there's no 12 gods in the top of Mount Olympus, but I've grown with the mythology. There's such importance to this place and it's just so beautiful. And I, between us and the rest of the world that's listening, I snuck in under the fence at night and I sat in the center of the temple and I meditated. And I heard this voice inside me, my voice, whatever voice. He who travels heals or dies learned. And that was a big answer for me in the sense that one of the things that really was hurting with the idea of dying was that I didn't become a shaman, that when I was 16, 17, 18, I was reading these books and I said, this is what I'm going to do when I grow up. I'll go and I'll meet my teachers and I'll venture out and find them in the Andes or in the jungles or wherever I have to go. And I hadn't done that. And I realized at that moment that I need to travel. Yes, I need to go and find them, even if it was to learn two or three things before I die, to come in touch with
the last. Yeah, he who travels heals or dies. What's the word? Learneth?
Learned. I don't know if it's an English correct word, but having learned.
Okay. Having learned. So the worst thing was you die, but you'd have learned what you wanted to learn.
I have learned and I have come in touch with them. And that night, or actually the next morning when I woke up,
Were you still there?
I was in Delphi in a little hotel, and I came out the balcony and I was sipping my coffee, and I realized that I'm sipping my coffee over this valley, where in the valley is this huge cave, which in ancient times was considered to be the cave, the entrance to Hades. And I'm like, oh my God, this, like, I might as well just walk down there and walk in there and just forget about it all and like here. And I want to bring it home because I referred to Carlos Castaneda. There was this one sentence from one of his books that just popped up in my brain at that moment when I said, I might as well just, you know, die. You know, since I'm here, I'll just go and walk down into Hades. And there was this one sentence that came up. And it was a moment where Don Juan tells Carlos Castaneda, when death knocks on your door, change your address. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I returned to Athens. I got a backpack, threw in 3 pieces of clothes, and booked myself a ticket for the United States and left my address in my address. And I realized, you know, back then when I read that, I thought it was some sort of metaphor, but this sentence coming up, and it's amazing how the brain does these things. Mm. This one sentence coming up, I just realized that I needed to not be there, because whatever led me to cancer, obviously the endless hours of work, I was obviously not ever being in the sun and always being under flashes and technical light. Obviously that kind of rhythm of life. And who knows what other environmental, other besides the obvious, really polluted Athens, especially back then. It's cleaned up significantly now. But I needed to leave all that. And I got a backpack and walked out of the back window of my life. And I never even told anyone. I never even, like, I just disappeared. I just got up and left. And I eventually ventured through Mexico and through Peru.
Where did you go in the U.S. when you landed?
I will tell you this, to give the whole story, because it's really important and it's really a big part of what I teach. Okay. I first went to Blacksburg, Virginia, where my sister lived. She was a professor at Virginia Technological Institute. And I stayed there with her and shared what was happening, and she supported me. And together we visited John Hopkins. And at John Hopkins, now, remember I said they gave me 3 months to live? This whole process essentially took about 6 to 7 months. And 7 months later, I'm still alive. And I go to John Hopkins. They too do CAT scans and MRIs, and the person there just lifted his hands and said, I'm really sorry. I said, there's nothing I can do. He said, I think that the best thing you should do is take care of your affairs. And I'm like, okay, I'll take care of my affairs. I feel blessed, because after 2 or 3 days, they call me from John Hopkins. They found my case interesting in the sense that I was diagnosed and I hadn't done anything, in the sense that there was a lot happening in my body with cancer. And they asked me if I would be interested in participating in a study in the NIH, the National Institute of Health in Washington, D.C. And I said, absolutely, yes. You know, my thought was like, well, if I'm going to die, I may as well be some help useful to humanity, you know, even silent. And I did have, and this is the big piece, and it's really important for everyone to hear, that I did one surgery, and I gave up my right kidney in January of 2005 at National Institute of Health. What do you call it? A radical nephrectomy. Like, they took the whole kidney away. I spent a few days or a few weeks after that. I traveled to Western Massachusetts to visit the yoga center Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health, to kind of like come over the surgery, give my body a little bit of time to R&R, to relax, to rejuvenate, to like see how things go. And it was wonderful. Parenthesis, I ended up staying at Kripalu. I ended up applying for a job, and I got the job. I became a yoga teacher at Kripalu in 2005. And I worked there for 15 years.
Now 2 years later, you're still alive, right?
Oh, 2 years later, I'm still alive. And in 2006, early 2006, within a year after my surgery, 2 years after my 90 days, I traveled to Mexico and searched for shamans. And then I found my way all the way down to Peru. And it was there where everything really started. It was there that I met shamans, and that I will say that till today, it is really clear to me that if I had not done that surgery, I would not be here today having this wonderful interview with you. If I had not met the shamans, I would not be here today doing this wonderful interview with you today. The essence was that I realized that if I had done the surgery and just went back home to my career and my life, then that life would lead me once again to where it led me, and that would be cancer and dying. There was obviously things there that stressed out my immune system, that stressed out my internal organs, the environment, the fast pace of life, etc. So it was really important to take out that one tumor and remove my right kidney. But again, if I had gone back, everything else would have caught up with me. The other kidney, my liver, my lungs, etc. But going so into...
I have two questions. Yeah. If you don't mind. Okay. So they took out the one kidney, but there was still cancer everywhere else? That was still there?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
And then how
did you get from Kripalu to Mexico? Like, what was that piece that hooked you into Mexico? I know you, as a 16-year-old, that's what you wanted, but how did, there you are being a yoga teacher, relaxing.
That was exactly it, that I realized that I need to learn. I realized, because there's still cancer, and they still said, you do not get your hopes high. You know, don't be realistic about this. We'll do other surgeries. We'll see how it's going to go. You know, take it one step at a time. So for me, that was an opportunity, because I still was alive and I was able to move, to walk, to be, to get up and go and find them. I met a lot of shamans in Mexico. Mexico is beautiful. I'll fast forward through that because I didn't meet my teachers there. And I found myself in Peru. I went to Peru, and it was there that I really, really found my teachers. And it was there where my training began. And it was there that I started realizing and learning and beginning to live in a very different way. And in the meantime, I would return back to the NIH every 3 months and do CAT scans and MRIs, because they were doing the post-op follow-ups to watch, because I was a study case, so they wanted to see some. So here I am in Peru, and I'll just refer to two stories, except if any of your questions bring me up to other stories, but two moments with two different teachers, one of them of which I still am very, very close to today. Actually, within 2 weeks, he will be coming to visit us in Greece. Wow. His name is just this wonderful person, Don Francisco Flores. And he's a renowned shaman in the world. He's a Quero. The Queros are the shamans of the Andes. So I am here in front of Don Francisco, and I'm on my knees, and I say, please, Don Francisco, heal me. I have cancer and I'm dying, and I need to be healed. And he leaned in towards me and he said, listen, I can't heal you, but I can train you to become a shaman, and you could heal yourself. And I stood up, I stood up and I said, and the same willingness that I enjoyed mopping floors and painting the walls, I'm like, tell me what to do. I'll be the best student. Just tell me what to do. I'll mop floors if you need me to. Whatever it is, tell me what to do. I would love to be your student. And there is this, my dream come alive that I could be an apprentice of a shaman. And here he is, and he's giving it to me. And I didn't also realize at that time he was giving me all the healing, because till that moment, through all the hospitals I went to, through all the way I was viewing this whole thing, I was a victim of this thing that was happening to me. It was happening to me, and I was constantly reaching out to doctors or to the CAT scans, the MRIs, to one hospital or the other, for them to heal me, and then asking him for him. Till that moment, no one said, Ray, you are the one that's going to heal this. It dawned on me, and I think a little bit later on, I really realized what he meant. But when he said that, I stood up and I came back to my willingness, to that willingness when I was 18 now, even though at the time, now I'm 39, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, tell me what to do, and I will be your student. I will be your best student. And I would love to learn, and I would love to heal myself from this. And what he did really is that he turned the responsibility to me, he gave it back to me. I got the wheel of this, and I wasn't anymore the victim of it, but I was in the place of the driver, and I was the one that could drive myself, hopefully, out of that. But automatically, he had taken me out of that emotion and out of that victim mentality, which of course is natural, because, you know, the experts or the other people or the big hospital. I mean, if John Hopkins is not the expert, and NIH is not an expert, who is really, right? But right. And they are by all means. And I have great appreciation, gratitude for my surgeons, for all those doctors, the nurses, people that held me, great appreciation. Yet when I took the power back to myself, that's when, and of course, having removed that big tumor, which was the source of all of it, mm-hmm. I was able to begin to step by step come out. And I worked with Don Francisco, and then I would go back to Peru. I would return back to NIH, do CAT scans and MRIs. One of the first things that the doctor said is like, whatever you're doing, keep on doing. You're doing it really good. Actually, in my first visit, I think it was like the second visit, he said, there's nothing in your lungs. I think there was a glitch in the MRI. It was the CAT scan MRI was a glitch in it. Your lungs are clear. And I'm like, I'll keep on doing what I'm doing. So I returned. And then within a year of going back and forth to Peru, I was told that there was a medicine man in the jungle close to the borders of Bolivia. And
Right. We're going to take our commercial break now. I'm going to write down Medicine Man in Bolivia so we know where we're going. And we're going to just have a word from our sponsor and we'll come right back. All right. So I think we're seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. So let's stop here and then we'll go through.
Perfect.
All right, cool. Be right back, everyone.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, thank you as always to our wonderful sponsor, KokoriApp.com. If you'd like to bring social, and I know it seems like it's a different topic from what we were talking about, but I'm sure it all relates, social, emotional, experiential, social, emotional learning to your children. And I think maybe that could teach them what Ray had when he was being a photographer, just that gratefulness, that being present in the moment. If you want to bring that to your children and teach them, you know, bring it to your schools. Go to KokoriApp.com, schedule a consultation, tell your schools, tell your businesses, whatever. I'm pumping on the words, but schools, businesses, teams, wherever you are, and bring that personal connection to wherever you are. Go again, KokoriApp.com. It's a platform, not an app. I was corrected by my daughter who works for them. It's a social, experiential, social, emotional learning platform. Okay. And then to plug my wonderful books, before we move on, my very first memoir, this was my story about where I was stuck and wondered what had happened to my life. It's called The Second Piece of French Toast. If marriage was my dream, why was I numbing myself? It helped me get out of my black hole. And I wrote it in case anybody else is stuck. It's a very courageous book. I tell it all. That's what Getting Real is all about. And, you know, you can find it on Amazon. My third book is Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, which also talks about getting from that dark side of life over to the happy side. These are tools and techniques that I discovered and wrote about because they helped me get, again, out of my rut. And then my third book was also a product of the first Real Talk, taught me how to speak up, taught me how, well, the book didn't. I wrote the book, but I learned how to speak up. I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony who everything was fine, but really it wasn't. And this helped me get freedom and a real life. Again, Getting Real with Hillary. Okay, you can go to realtalkwithhillary.com, set up a consultation, do the Real Talk quiz, see how real you are. And it's a lot of fun. Okay, back to Ray. We're going to hear the rest of the story. And I'm excited to hear the rest. Here we go. All right. You had heard about a medicine man in Bolivia. So go ahead. So the NIH was seeing progress. You obviously were still alive. And okay, take us to Bolivia.
So still in Peru, but very close to the borders. Bolivia, in deep jungle, took the airplane, took a boat down the river called Madre de Dios, and then hiked deep into the jungle to this tribe or this compound where I met this shaman. And I was tired. I was exhausted with the travels. It was very hot. The jungle is very unforgiving and very difficult. I still didn't have all, you know, a bill of clean health. So I was still in, there was days and days. There was days I had agony and fear and I would cry or be afraid. There was days I would be more optimistic. But because I was kind of broken by the time I had arrived there, I once again still forgot a little bit and gave my power to this man, all my hope. It's like, okay, well, so many people told me that he is like amazing. And I fell on my knees crying. And I said, please help me. I have a 2-year-old son back in Greece that needs his father, right? Because all of this, small, beautiful detail, like I was diagnosed when my son was 8 months old. So imagine the turmoil in my heart through the whole process. And I'm here I am and I'm crying and I'm begging him to save me. And he just put his hand right in front of my face and he said, I don't care about my own emotions. What makes you think I'm going to care about your emotions? And I did exactly that. I was just like, I was taken aback. I stopped crying. I was like, what? I'm like, my head is spinning. I'm like, I'm at the wrong place. What have I done? I've come all this way. They're probably just going to, I'm going to die here. They're going to push me in a ditch, roll me over a ditch, and no one will ever find me. I'm getting up. I'm like wiping my face from the tears. I stand up. I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say, well, this was a mistake. You're not a healer. You're not compassionate. I don't know what I was going to say. I was really turned off, to say the least. And as I inhaled and I was like now in front of him, kind of like ready to confront him, he put it out his arm and put it on my shoulder and said, okay, my brother, now you seem ready to do the work. Let's do this. So the second and even deeper lesson, the same lesson in two different tribes, two different kind of shamans, shamanism, he gave me the same lesson. It's like, what did he forget? You're the driver. Do not let your emotions drag you down. Was I right to be crying, to be afraid, to be mourning? Of course I was. And all emotions are justified. And it's important to have emotions. But here I was, and with cancer, I was in moments where I was crying so much that I was creating this acidic environment in my whole body. I was creating more fear. I was feeding the fear. I was feeding on it. And he just tricked me. He just tricked me right out of it. And I stood up and I'm like, I'm out of here. It's just like I took again back my own power. I took power back in my own hands. And I did a lot of medicine plants. We walked through the jungle. We collected different plants. He taught me about roots. He taught me about flowers, about leaves, about stems. But there's the biggest pharmaceutical company that we have on the planet is the Amazon jungle. Mm. The biggest and the best. Wow. Biggest and the best. And I journeyed with him. I went through catharsis. I went through practices and trainings and many of them were difficult. There's a lot of, dark nights and a lot of nights of fear that although were without me knowing it, my own hero's journey. Mm. Staying alone at the top of a specific tree in the middle of the jungle alone at 30 feet is one of the scariest things I've ever done in my life, where he's like, you stay up there and I will come tomorrow to pick you up. And he didn't come till the next afternoon. It was more like 30 hours or so.
Wow. But you did what he said. You followed what he said.
I did.
Even though you were scared, you did it.
I love him for everything that he did for me. And little did I know that beloved Maestro Panduro, a decade later, he passed. And I am still alive.
Wow.
But when I was looking at him, I was looking at someone that I thought was, an immortal shaman. And there is no one that's immortal. Christ was immortal, not Buddha was immortal. We all are immortal and we all live our life. We all learn through it and we all go through the journey that we're here to live. And here's where I feel we're really coming into the story is that I feel it's really clear that one needs to engage in life, to assume responsibility and engage. It's exactly like you said with your book. It's like, let's get real. Let's stop being phony. Let's stop doing what everyone else wants. Let's stop being people pleasers or society pleasers or being in the box of what society says and really just look into our heart and put in the hard work and engage. I think if there's something that a word I love, that's the word engage.
Go ahead. When you were telling that story and he said, let's do that. Like I had a similar situation. It wasn't part of the book, but it was when I had filed for divorce and I was just frozen. And I had a friend who was like, well, what are you doing? And I was just like, it was like kind of the same thing. Like, look, I put my hands out. I was getting up to go. And she looked at me and said, you're better than this. And she stared me in the eyes. And I had that moment of, okay, let's do this. And the reason I bring it up is she just passed away like a week ago. But she made that difference for me to stop being powerless and bring the power. And when you said that the guy, you know, you were like, I'm obviously in the wrong place. Like, that's how I felt too. Like, I don't need this crap. But she, she gave me the power, you know? Yeah. And I've done that for others now. When they're, you know, I'm like, no, you're strong, you know, and it snaps them out of it. So
a little hard love, huh?
Yeah.
It's tough love, what do you call it?
Yeah. And it, you know what? Sometimes you'll know, talking to the audience, when someone needs it and you give them that belief back and get them out of, you know, snap them back. So anyway, all right, keep going. So you were talking, sorry for interrupting, but master.
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. This is where I love the conversation and I love the parallels. And I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah. But she, you know, she did that. But she did that for me. And I will always be a better person for having known her, you know? Yeah.
That is beautiful.
Yeah. She actually had brain cancer. So I wish, you know what? If this was a few months ago, I could have sent her down to Peru, right? Or to Mexico. Anyway.
I would be happy to have met her. Yeah. But we all live our karma. We all live our destiny. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Always.
Yeah.
Always.
All right. So after that.
Here I am in the jungle working with him. And one of my favorite walks with him was this jaguar path, this path that jaguars walk. And we would walk and we'd always see footprints and we'd always go up to the river to where they would go and drink water. Only many years later did I see a jaguar there. But in the meantime, we just walked down this path and it was endless. And it was a path, like, again, because like humans like to make trails, I didn't know that animals do the same. They walk a specific route, and through walking through a daily, there is a path that's created. And it's very clear in the jungle, the path. And through walking on the jaguar path, at some point, my teacher from the mountains, from the Andes, Don Francisco, said to me, you are healed now. And if you want to be and remain healed, you have to start teaching what you've learned. And I'm like my second, maybe third year of apprenticeship. And I'm like, how will I teach this? It's like, who am I to teach this? How will I teach it? And he turned around and said to me, he will teach it in English. They always had humor. They always kind of pulled the rug under my feet. In other words, you will teach it in a way that people in the Western world will understand it and it will make sense. And because I would spend time with both of these beloved teachers, going and walking in the jaguar path and in one of the ceremonies that I've done and the journey that I did, I was given the idea, the download. I was actually given a whole download that what I need to do in order to stay cancer-free and to live is create a school, as I was instructed, that would be called the Jaguar Path. It would be a 9-month training, and it would be separated in 3 trimesters. 9 months, obviously, to being reborn.
Wow.
Right? A gestation period of 9 months. And it had 3 trimesters. And the 3 trimesters were what we call in Peru the Inca trilogy. It's the totem of the serpent, the jaguar, and the condor. And in the jungle, I wrote, and all the tools that they had taught me, I started putting them together, along with things that I had learned before in my life that I considered were along this path of healing with cancer and dealing with cancer. I brought together the tools that really helped me heal. And in essence, to make it really clear also, it's like I brought together the tools that really changed who I was. Because when you change who you are, that's where it came. That's when I actually changed my address. When death was knocking my door, I changed my address. My address was who I was, what my everyday thoughts were, what my emotions were, what was that my endocrine reality was, right?
Wow.
And I changed that. And in these 3 trimesters now on the Jaguar Path, you know, here we are 20 years later. We opened the Jaguar Path. I opened the Jaguar Path, and it was in 2008. I have taught it over 20 times the same curriculum out of the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health. I've taught these classes out of Guru Spirit in Costa Rica and out of the Jaguar Path studio, what we used to have. And now this last 4 years, we are online throughout the world. And the idea of these three trimesters is, again, that you have this 9 months of gestation of like being reborn and restructuring your whole being. And serpent, the first 3 months, it's the first trimester where we have that morning sickness. And it's like where we go basically into the little bit of a difficult part, but very lovingly, with amazing support, we kind of look into things that we consider traumas. In those first 3 months, we change this and we go through tools. We go through this tool. One of my favorite tools, which I started doing with both Francisco and Maestro Pandura, was cord cutting. Cord cutting is an amazing tool where it says, well, if you you were in a relationship, you're going through a divorce like you did. It's like, how do you restart your life? Because you've had this connection with this person. I had a child with my ex-wife, my son, like I just mentioned. How do I begin my life when I'm still connected to this person and all this situation? So you cut the energetic cords. And when you cut the energetic cords, that gives you the ability to really begin to think differently, to be able to become more you and not be informed by this energetic cord that feeds you these patterns or this way of relating and being.
Wow. So Ray, we have 4 minutes left. I want to make sure people know, because I mean, this is fascinating. I think we could do a whole nother show on this, but I want to make sure that people can find you. And if they want to know more about this training, where they go to find you and, what the timing is and stuff like that.
Absolutely, yes. Well, jaguarpath.com.
What is jaguarpath.com? Jaguarpath.com. Okay. And we'll put that in the
show. And I want to say that these 9 months, and I can absolutely do it in 4 minutes and say,
okay, good.
That we go serpent, which we learn tools of letting go of the past and healing. We go into jaguar, where we learn how to think without fear, because the jaguar is on the top of the food chain and knows no fear. So we work with words, we work with different, what we call contracts that we've made in our mind, and we change those. And the third trimester, as we move into finishing the school and being anew, is Condor. And at Condor, we rise above the collective consciousness, and we rise above our previous self and the collective consciousness ways of thinking, kind of like come out of these boxes. And we get real. I love your title. It's about getting real and not being about what other people think and what other people say, but rather getting real and becoming fully, fully you.
Wow.
We have amazing people from all over the world. We have people that are in the medicine field, doctors, therapists. We have yoga teachers. We have Reiki practitioners. We have body workers. We have people that want healing, and we have people that are healers. Wherever you're at in that, 100%, all our graduates say this is life-changing. And I'll say only this also to that 25% of the people that take the training take it again for a second and the third and a fourth year, the same training. The depth of it is unparalleled. And the more you go into it, the deeper you get into it, the more you learn, the more you expand, the more you really find your personal power and freedom.
Wow. And it's starting again in November, right? November to June, you said?
Yes. We always start 9 month training, 1 weekend a month. Our first weekend is November 16th, 17th. Coming right up.
Wow. All right.
And
so
you can find all the information at jaguarpath.com.
Awesome. All right. So what, in the last minute or so, what if let's say this takes off, or I know it is taking off, but what is your vision for the world?
I think it is now time, more than ever, now is time for us to reconnect with nature. The biggest thing that I've learned through this shamanic apprenticeship that I've been in, I am working with these shamans, is that they're very real. And what makes them real is that they're connected with nature. They're connected with power animals. They're connected with the rivers. They're connected with the sea. They're connected. And that gives you a new, a brand new, for us, unfortunately, a new vitality, something we've lost. Living in the cities, with technology coming up, with AI coming up, we're further and further away from nature, which takes us further from our own nature. And when I look at all the difficulty people have, mental health issues being in the rise, all that stems from a disconnect that we have that's been created through how we've evolved through technology. And I love to keep it real. For me, it's important for everyone to understand that we need Western medicine when we need it, but it's important to open our heart and our mind for these ancient practices that teach us what is actually true and real. It is about becoming more real. It's about becoming more authentic, and it's about living the life you want. So my goal is to reach 1 million people in this next decade to offer them this way of being and to offer that as a collective, as a new collective, offer it to the world so we can change our vibration, so we could bring our vibration back to, we love this earth, we love this planet, we love the animals, the rivers, we love living and being here, dancing, playing, singing, working, and get this as a vibration that lifts the vibration of the whole rest of the world, because it seems that a lot of other things are getting in the way.
Thank you.
It's about becoming authentic, and it's about living, each one of us living their authentic life and finding their authentic voices.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for what you're doing in the world. And it's just thank you.
Thank you, Hillary. The pleasure was all mine. Thank you for what you do.
You're welcome. All right.
Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.